I want to welcome everybody to our last oral argument case of the day. We're obviously thrilled to be back in person, have been for a year now, but it's always nice when we get to do this. So I'll introduce the panel that you have today. To my left is Justice Mike Wallach. To my right is Justice Dana Womack, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand the attorneys have checked in, and so I'll ask the clerk to call the case. You may proceed, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Steve Fleckman, and I represent the appellants. Brad Spaulding and Wendy Yates are beneficiaries of Betty Jo Heitch's trust. Ms. Heitch died in 2020 in April of that year, and our appellee opponent is Ms. Jean Bennett, who is the trustee and also a beneficiary of the trust. We are here over a fairly narrow issue, and the narrow issue is, does the record below support the grant of an award of reimbursed expenses to the trustee, Ms. Bennett, in the amount of $86,000? We take issue with that award, and we have appealed from that judgment. The issue here involves basically three topics that I'd like to touch on today in the time allotted to me. First of all, the issue of the trustee's discretion, because the trustee has argued that she has broad and unlimited discretion to decide the issues before you herself, and we take issue with that contention. The second thing I'd like to touch on is a portion of the award which relates to the attorney's fees. And that's about $51,000 of the 80-some-odd thousand dollars in issue. The second, the third topic is the affidavit that was presented by the trustee during the trial as Defendant's Exhibit 14. Which we maintain does not meet the requirements, the narrow requirements, of the business records exception to the hearsay rule. I'll start with the pleading. There is no pleading by the trustee in this case asking for relief as to attorney's fees or reimbursable expenses.
Pardon me, how come that wasn't tried by consent? I mean, you showed up for a hearing. There was a continuance that both parties wanted to have so they could get their stuff cleaned up and ready to try the issue of attorney's fees. You tried it. How come the issue wasn't tried by consent?
You can look at it as having been tried by consent, Justice Wallach. I think that there is a different way to look at it, and that is we tried the case. That is to say, we did not waive our contention. And we repeated it, or rather we urged it repeatedly during the course of the trial, that she had not qualified for relief by pleading for it under Rule 301. That being the case, I will assume for purposes of my argument that it was tried by consent. What I think was tried by consent was the issue of her claim to a portion of the deposits in the court and our claim to a portion of the deposits in the court, and we could not get through, if you will, the gate on that issue without having a trial, because the Rule 11 orders that had been entered required the parties to make their arguments, whatever they may be, as to the distribution of those funds. So by trying the case, we did not believe we were waiving, and we reserved and, as I say, continue to urge our objection to the absence of a pleading. But I'm going to now address the issues as though it was tried by consent without waiving that argument. First of all, the trustee's discretion. The trustee has the highest fiduciary duties known to the law in Texas. And The question then is, does that entitle the trustee to unlimited discretion? And the answer to that is supplied by the trust. It's supplied by the trust code, and it's supplied by the common law. Starting then with the question of the trust, in our handout to the court, in tab 2, you'll see the trust provisions. And tab 2 makes it absolutely clear from the trust that there's a mandate. And the mandate is that the trustee may obtain reimbursement of reasonable expenses. The law on that is will be familiar to the court, and that is that in a contract or a trust, the provisions must be read as an entirety. They must be harmonized, and so that all provisions are respected. And the purpose of that is to ensure here that the trustees' wishes and expectations and directives are respected. So the trustee has said the expenses to be reimbursed must be reasonable, and there are no exceptions or qualifications to this in her language. The second thing is that the trust code, and the trust code provisions are set out at the next tab, 3, and the trust code provisions respect the wishes and directives of the settlor. So if you look at 111.0035, section 111.0035B, you'll find there that the terms of a trust prevail over any provision of this Texas statute and of this subtitle of the Texas statute, which embraces, by the way, sections 114063, on which the trustee relies, and 114064, on which we rely. And it goes on to say that a trustee's duty is to act in accordance with the purposes of the trust, and second, that the trust may not limit, even if it contained broad discretion, unqualified discretion, it may not limit the power of the court to make an award under section 114.064, which is an instruction by the legislature that the code provision governing attorney's fees applies to proceedings involving trust disputes. And we have here a proceeding involving a trust dispute. Now, the third qualification and constraint on the trustee's powers appears in the common law of this state. And here, those, as I said, fiduciary standards are high. They involve good faith, loyalty, which involves disclosure, care, fair dealing, skill, prudence, and capability. And one of the things that we are contending is that common law here is also a qualification. In essence, what I would say is that the law doesn't say that a trustee has absolutely unqualified discretion. What the law essentially says is that a trustee has unlimited discretion to do the right thing, and nothing but the right thing by the terms of the settlor. So we have here a situation where we also have, as you said, the issue here has been litigated. It's been confided to the court because the court had to distribute the proceeds of the registry. So we have the involvement of a court by consent. That much we concede. The next thing is that the evidentiary rules place the burden of proof on the claimant. The claimant for attorney's fees must establish that they are reasonable and necessary under Rormus from the Texas Supreme Court in 2019. The court also requires that the trustee make an affirmative showing to establish a right to reimbursement of expenses. Those are the burdens of the trustee, not the burdens of the beneficiary, for obvious reasons. The trustee is in possession of the essential fact information. You will find that this record is devoid of any evidence supporting attorney's fees whatsoever. The court made appropriate rulings in this case, appropriate rulings, that all evidence as to reasonableness would be excluded, not only as to attorney's fees, but as to, quote, all things regarding reasonableness, excluded. Documentary evidence, including the invoices of the law firm of Miss Bennett, and testimonial. So there was no and is no testimony in this record and no cross appeal from this ruling. There is no evidence in this record whatsoever from an expert as to invoices that support the attorney's fees or as to the testimony of any expert. Now, a lay person cannot testify as to the reasonableness of attorney's fees. The only thing we have from the trustee, Miss Bennett, is an unqualified business records affidavit. It purports to be a business records affidavit. It is anything but. It's an instrument of litigation advocacy for herself. It is not sworn to. The documents in it are not sworn to. There are exhibits.
I did not see a hearsay objection. Did you make one?
Yes, I did make one. I made a clear objection to both its qualification as a business record under the business records exception rule and also as to its the admission for truthfulness.
You think an objection to truthfulness is the same thing as an objection to hearsay?
I think that the way I phrased it was its admissibility to prove truthfulness. Yes, I believe that that's what hearsay is. Hearsay is the out-of-court assertion admitted for the purpose or presented, if you will, for the purpose of establishing the truth of the matter asserted. And I objected that it was not a business record affidavit, and also that it was not it did not qualify for admission as a statement of truthfulness, only as a statement of her contentions or her claim, and nothing more than that. And I stand by that. If you would look at tab 5, you will see the evidentiary rulings of the court. But here's where the court sustained the ruling as to any evidence of reasonableness. There is none in this record. And Justice Wallach, if I might point out, you will not find any evidence of reasonableness in Ms. Bennett's affidavit. There is no mention of the word reasonable or reasonableness in that affidavit. None.
Under Rormos, you create a presumption by having number of hours worked times hourly rate.
But Rormos says the following. Rormos says that the proponent of, or rather the applicant for attorney's fees, must bear the burden of proof to show both. Now, if I might respond to your question, you will not find any evidence in this record from any expert as to the reasonable hours or the reasonable rate. And that's the minimum requirement of Rormos. There can be adjusting factors, but that's the minimum requirement. No evidence, because my objection to that was sustained. And the reason it was sustained is because the attorney on the other side did not timely designate his firm or himself as an expert. But I will also address your point about the business records affidavit. The business records rule in 803.6 and in 902.10 is a narrow exception to the rule that hearsay is not admissible. And in order to qualify for that, the author of the business record must show that it is a routine record maintained in the ordinary course of an ongoing business. This is anything but. This is an affidavit of advocacy. And what we learn in Ortega, the Ortega case, which we briefed, is that advocacy in a business records affidavit is considered extraneous. That's the word the court uses. And extraneous argument in a business record affidavit is not qualified. Moreover, when someone has prepared a business record, an affidavit, as an instrument of court advocacy in anticipation of litigation, then you don't have a business record affidavit anymore. The extraneous information, the contentions that she made that her fees were necessary and the expenses were necessary, is, as to attorney's fees, merely lay testimony in any event. Secondly, it's extraneous because what Ortega teaches is that the purpose of the business records affidavit is solely to identify the business records and nothing more. Anything extraneous in the way of advocacy as to the material issues of the case should be stricken and disregarded. I made that objection. The court said he understood my objection to the admission of the affidavit for truthfulness. He said, I understand. He then made no ruling at that point other than to admit it. He didn't indicate whether it was admitted for a narrow purpose or for a general purpose. I came back later in the case. There had been no testimony as to that affidavit before I came back at the end. And before judgment was entered, I re-urged my objection, explained further to the court why.
Thank you, counsel. Your time's up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Daniel Aguilar on behalf of the appellee. I know everyone's disappointed Mr. Ferris is not here arguing this. I'll just have to be here in his stead. I'm going to pick up where Mr. Fleckman left off on the admissibility of the affidavit of expenses, Defendant's Exhibit 14. The exchange that occurred, we offered the document into evidence. The court asked any objection, and this is the exchange that happened. Your Honor, I don't think it's a business record, appropriate business record, but I have no objection to it being offered as the defendant's request for expenses. The court, all right. So there is no objection to 14 being admitted and then considered, correct? That's correct, Your Honor. And I don't think it could get much clearer than that. The document was offered and the document was admitted. There was no limitation of any kind.
Let's assume it was properly admitted. Where does it talk about reasonableness anyway?
In the affidavit, in paragraph 2, Mrs. Bennett testifies that the chart which is attached includes receipts and invoices where applicable. These expenses were incurred on behalf of the trust based on my reasonable belief that the same were necessary to administer the trust in accordance with its terms and to preserve the trust assets.
Okay, well, she talks about a reasonable belief. That's a belief that the same were necessary. How does that establish either reasonableness or necessity?
Your Honor, I would say Mrs. Bennett's affidavit, it goes to the issue of whether she incurred the expenses reasonable in good faith and incurred them reasonably. She is not testifying as an expert as to attorney's fees. I'm not going to stand here and tell you that she is. She testifies that they were incurred in good faith and the amounts are set forth therein, but she was not testifying as an expert, so I'm not going to try and tell you that she was, Your Honor.
Does it say that the expenses, any of them, were reasonable, whether it's attorney's fees or anything else?
Your Honor, I'm not sure if she specifically says they are reasonable. I'm not sure that certain magic words are necessary to show that they are from the trustee. In this instance, she testified as to why they were incurred, what they were incurred for, and that it was for the benefit of the trust. In this scenario, when there's no findings of fact and conclusions of law, I mean, I think we could make the assumption that the court found that there was reasonableness. So we simply don't have findings, but the court made its decision based on the evidence before it.
Actually, the judgment does say reasonable expenses that she incurred. My question is, where is the evidence which supports that finding? And so if we have the expense affidavit which lists expenses, who they were paid to, and a very brief note as to, in some cases, maybe what they were for, to kind of surmise what it's about. But where is evidence that anything that was incurred was reasonable?
Your Honor, her testimony into paragraph 2 and paragraph 3, and I'm looking back over it here again. I mean, she lists the context in which the fees were incurred for the betterment of the trust, and there's not magic words that these were reasonable. She testifies that they were incurred in good faith to benefit the trust, and I believe that's good enough to get us there as far as what the purpose of the expense is.
Why is it not conclusory?
Your Honor, it's not conclusory because she presents the expenses themselves. She doesn't just say, I incurred $100,000 and, you know, with no further explanation as to their purpose.
So if we look at AAA Texas membership with a number and an amount of $176, I'm supposed to know if that's reasonable? I don't even know what it's for.
And, Your Honor, she testifies that these expenses were incurred for the benefit of the trust. I believe there was an automobile was part of the assets off the top of my head. I would say it lists the dates of all these transactions, but paragraph 2 and paragraph 3 are her description along with this attachment. And The testimony that she incurred for the benefit of the trust, the trial court was the judge of the credibility of that testimony and took that as adequate to believe that the trustee did in fact incur these in her discretion for the benefit of the trust property. And, Your Honor, to step back a little bit, at the beginning of Mr. Fleckman's presentation, he characterized our position as that the trustee had unlimited, unqualified discretion in incurring expenses. That's not our position. The trustee was to act reasonably. I believe where the two sides, it appears, were talking past each other as to who was the judge of reasonableness and at what time. And in this scenario, we have the appellants filing a removal of trustee claim. That was the sole cause of action. Now, if the funds had not been deposited into the registry of the court, once the trial court denied the removal claim, the trial court would be done. And then in that scenario, who decides how the assets are distributed? Well, the trustee does, according to the trust, with the discretion granted to her by the trust document. Now, by merely depositing the funds into the registry while the removal action was pending, I don't see any authority for why that would strip the trustee of her discretion to incur funds, incur expenses that she believed were reasonable, and would impose upon her now to perform her duties as trustee. She has to have a mini trial as to the reasonableness of every expense. For example, the trust document, Section 6.6, Section 7.4, the trustee is allowed to hire attorneys, allowed to hire a CPA. Once the removal action was denied, does the trustee have to have a mini hearing on was it reasonable to employ a CPA to do taxes, or is that not within the trustee's discretion to manage these assets? And on that note, we cite in our briefing Corpus Christi Bank and Trust versus Roberts out of the Supreme Court of Texas, 1980. In that case, the trustee had hired a real estate manager because real estate was part of the trust corpus. The trust beneficiaries challenged the trustee's decision to pay fees to the manager, alleging breach of fiduciary duty. The Supreme Court analyzed the predecessor statutes to the current section of the trust code that are currently in place, noting that the trustee was authorized to employ attorneys, accountants, agents, and brokers reasonably necessary in the administration of the trust estate. Now, that decision, the Supreme Court found, was the authority was granted to the trustee to determine whether those agents should be hired. The trustee did not have to go get pre-approval to hire this property manager. And the trustee would not have to go get pre-approval to hire an accountant or an attorney and incur fees for that purpose. Similarly, in the De Portanova versus Monroe case cited in our brief, the procedural history has some twists and turns, but the upshot of it was one of the representatives of the beneficiary filed a declaratory judgment action asking the court to weigh in as to whether certain distributions were in the best interest of the beneficiary. And the Court of Appeals said, hold on, the best interest of the beneficiary, those decisions are discretionary decisions left to the trustee. To quote the Court of Appeals, I believe it was the first Court of Appeals out of Houston, the trustees, not the court, are given the power to determine the best interest of the beneficiary. A court cannot substitute its discretion for that of a trustee and can interfere with the exercise of discretionary powers only in the case of fraud, misconduct, or clear abuse of discretion. And then it goes on, in this case, there's been no pleading or proof that the trustee has acted with mala fides or lack of good faith. Instead, by seeking a declaratory judgment that the trustees are authorized to fund the proposed trust, i.e., that funding the trust is in the beneficiary's best interest, the guardian has effectively bypassed the trustees and prevented them from determining what action, in their opinion, would be in the best interest of the beneficiary.
Once you put the money in the registry of the court, doesn't the court have an obligation to see that the funds that are being dispersed are being done reasonably?
The court has broad discretion in how to apply these funds. When funds are placed in the registry of the court has great latitude in dealing with them and is bound by it just can't be an abuse of discretion.
It's in the nature of equity, is it not?
I believe that would be part of the court's equitable powers. Yes, it would, Your Honor. And in that context, we approached the court and said, okay, the removal action has been denied. All that is now left is what does the court want to do with the proceeds from this trust? Because the removal action was done, we were back to square one, meaning the trustee is in control of the trust. The trustee has all the powers given to her under the trust document and the trust agreement. We would posit that in that scenario, we could have simply asked, Judge, removal has been denied. She's still the trustee. Send the money to Mrs. Bennett, and she will distribute it in accordance with the trust document.
We'd probably be deciding some different questions at that point today.
We probably would, Your Honor. And out of an abundance of caution, we wanted to go ahead. We even mentioned that somewhere in the record at trial. And I'll say the same thing I said then. We're presenting these questions to the court because we want this done. You know, out of an abundance of caution, we want to show what she did, what the expenses are. And in her discretion, she determined that these are reasonable expenses. And her affidavit was admitted with all the attachments. And as I referenced earlier, without a valid objection. So
if a trustee presents an affidavit like this, and that's the only evidence of, let's say, the attorney's fee component, what was reasonable, and the trustee says in this estate that was worth whatever the total estate was, let's say it was $1 million estate, and in my opinion the necessary attorney's fees were $5 million, nobody gets to second guess that?
The other parties would get a chance to second guess that, Your Honor, and let me give you an analogy. Let's say, for example, if the trustee had said, well, I'm in charge of these assets. I think it's reasonable to buy a Ferrari that only I can drive for the estate. And would other people have a say in that? They certainly could. They could say, you breached your fiduciary duty. That's not a proper expense. And file suit and show that there was a fraud, misconduct, or a clear abuse of discretion, in which case that would certainly not be a proper expense. In this scenario, there were attorney's fees expended for the last, I want to say, it was about a year's time. Under the trust code and the trust documents, Mrs. Bennett could have applied trust assets every month that a bill was sent in. She had discretion to do that, just how she could have in April of each year if she was paying the taxes for the trust. Now, the test would be, is she acting within her discretion? At the time, whenever she makes those payments, she is the person who decides whether that is a reasonable expense. And that's always potentially subject to a claim for breach of fiduciary duty. But there doesn't need to be pre-approval. There doesn't need to be a mini trial to pay the accountant. That's why the trustee is granted discretion to incur those fees and pay those fees. Now, in this scenario, the appellants had an opportunity to allege that there was a breach of fiduciary duty. If she had said it was $1 million, they had their opportunity to say, no, Judge, she has, to quote one of these cases, the court may not submit a dispute its discretion of the trustee and may interfere only in the case of fraud, misconduct, or clear abuse of discretion. They had their opportunity to show all those things at trial, and the court denied all these substantive claims for removal.
But does the trustee get to decide what an amount of reasonable attorney's fees is?
Yes, the trustee does, Your Honor. For example,
does it require expert testimony?
The trust documents and the trust code allow the trustee to decide it's reasonable for me to pay this accountant. It's reasonable for me to pay this attorney. In this scenario, because of those powers granted to the trustee, she doesn't have to go out every time a bill comes in from any professional and get pre-approval that that the fees are reasonable and necessary and put on expert testimony. If that were the case, I mean, effectively, the code sections, and I'm going to jump to them here. Looking at Property Code Section 114.063, General Right to Reimbursement, and the text states, a trustee may discharge or reimburse himself from trust principal or any income or partly from both for, one, advances made for the convenience, benefit, or protection of trust property, two, expenses while administering or protecting the trust or because of the trustee's holding or owning of any of the trust property. And in that code section, there is not a limitation as to the trustee may reimburse himself only upon court order or only upon application. This is a right that the trustee has discretion to execute at the time. The way I read that, I don't read reimburse himself anything other than the trustee makes the decision as to whether those reimbursements can be made. And as with my silly example, I'll admit, of buying a Ferrari, if the trustee were to allege, oh, this is reasonable, that could be subject to a breach of fiduciary duty attack, and they would have the opportunity to present that to the court, much like there was appellants had an opportunity to allege breach of fiduciary duty in the underlying removal action. If we were standing here and there were a finding that she had breached a fiduciary duty, then this whole thing would be in a different light. Instead, all the allegations of misconduct were denied by the court. That's out. There's no showing of the fraud, misconduct, or clear abuse of discretion that the cases require to impinge upon the trustee's discretion that paying the accountant is reasonable, paying the attorney is reasonable, paying the guy painting the house before it gets sold is reasonable. If that were not the case, then suddenly the trustee really doesn't have discretion to do all these things. The trustee can just apply to the court for expenses to pay the gardener, you know, those types of things. But that runs counter, I would say, to the holding in the Corpus Christi Bank case, to the DePortnova versus Monroe case, when the court says The trustees, not the court, are given the power to make these determinations as to what is in the best interest of the beneficiaries. And in
but those cases don't deal with a situation where you have, by contract, agreed to put the money into the registry of the court and make it subject to court order, correct?
That is true, Your Honor. I don't think in any of the cases cited by Mr. Fleckman or in any of the cases that we cited in our brief, I don't think there are funds in the registry of any of those cases. We certainly look for them. But I would say that by mere virtue of placing the funds in the registry of the court, that alone did not take matters and suddenly she has the burden of proof to have expert testimony to incur expenses the trust document let her incur, particularly once the trial court has made its ruling that there is no removal of trustee. If there's no misconduct that has been shown, then the parties challenging the discretion of the trustee are the ones who have to show fraud, misconduct, or clear abuse of discretion on behalf of the trustee. And that's not appealed in this case. If the denial of the merits on the breach of fiduciary action, it's not before the court. Any allegation that she misused any of these funds, court said no, that's not before this court. That can't be a basis to undercut the decision of the trustee to incur any of the fees at issue in this case. And I think I've hit about everything in the 10 seconds I have left.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Aguilar has mentioned to you the objections to the business records affidavit in part, but not in whole. If I might direct you to the objections as they appear in tab 7 of the handout that we have provided. Before there was any further discussion in the case about any substantive matter, I followed my initial objection by pointing out, Your Honor, if I might say, we are not agreeing that it is a document that is truthful. I added that to the objection. I then repeated the objection. I re-urged the objection on the next page, which is part of tab 7, and explained to the court that the affidavit had not authenticated any of the exhibits except A. And the exhibits went from A through L. B through L were not ever authenticated. They're not sworn. And if you take a look at tab 8, which is the affidavit of expenses, the reason that we have only put in exhibit A is because you don't have any affidavit evidence whatsoever as to the swearing, the authentication of the other exhibits. But take, if you would, notice of the first page of the affidavit. It says, the second page, it says, I deny all allegations of wrongdoing. That's extraneous argument. That's exactly what the Ortega case is saying. One cannot insert arguments into a business records affidavit. They are extraneous. They will not be admitted. There are no evidence. So we have here a bare bones affidavit with no authentication of the exhibits whatsoever. The exhibits are not in the record. The second thing I'd like to mention is that a conclusory, as Justice Wallach, you have pointed out, parts of that affidavit are conclusory. A conclusory objection can be raised at any time on appeal. And that's out of the City of San Antonio against Pollock case out of the Texas Supreme Court in 2009, 284 Southwest 3rd, 809 at 816. In addition, the proponent of hearsay has the burden of showing that the testimony fits within an exception to the general rule that hearsay is not allowed.
Isn't that after a hearsay objection is made.
It is, but, Your Honor, I would submit that you don't need to have magic words to an objection. That's clear. What is important is that it be clear enough as to the basis and that it be understood by the court. The court said that he understood, that he used the term, I understand. And so I take that to mean that he understood. This is not a business records affidavit, and it cannot be admitted for the truth of the matter asserted. I will tell you candidly that I had a senior moment. I wish I had remembered the word hearsay. And those do occasionally occur. But I think that the objection was clear in this regard. Now, I'd like to ask if you would just to turn with me to tab 9, because tab 9 shows that this is an engagement of Ms. Bennett's law firm for the purpose of litigating this case and a parallel probate case. That's in the first paragraph 1, and that is why section 114.064 code, the trust code, applies here, because the sections that we have referenced, including 111.0035B, state specifically that the trustee cannot supplant the application of the code section that applies to attorney's fees. Once the attorney's fees apply, it's a fee-shifting provision. Every fee-shifting provision is covered by Rormos. It requires that there be expert evidence as to reasonable rate and reasonable hours. In addition, the statement that she is not required to prove her requested attorney's fees are reasonable and necessary is contrary to the Kurtz decision. Kurtz, which we have...
I'm afraid your time's up, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate the oral argument. It's been helpful. Your case is now submitted.